Hi, Drumstick. Oh, Drumstick, I think is going to be very happy.
I feel confident because I'm the best player in the world.
And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.
Did you do any PEDs?
No.
Did you do anything that they accuse you of?
No.
People are laughing at us all over the world. They think we're stupid, and we are. I mean, we're being led by stupid people.
That I needed to arm myself, that I needed to protect Reva and I, that I needed to get my gun.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Owen Paul James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder.
There's massive, massive sports betting going on.
We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
I'm a very stable genius.
It's time for Offside. Now, here's your host, TSN Informs legal analyst and Canada's favorite lawyer, Eric Macramella.
He's a lawyer.
Welcome to the show that is Offside. I'm your host, Eric Macramel, and welcome to all the listeners across the country in Edmonton, Montreal, and in Ottawa. Steve Lloyd is away this week. He's down at Comic-Con walking around dressed like Baby Yoda. A lot on the show today. I'll be in conversation with Ryan Pidlick from the Montreal Canadiens. But here in this segment, I'm in conversation with Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues. The influence of the Negro Leagues is undeniable, and the players that played in that league were some of the highest caliber players. And of course, players who were denied an opportunity to play Major League Baseball until Jackie Robinson integrated the game by way of Branch Rickey and the Los Angeles Dodgers. So this is a really important conversation to have. And so here is my conversation with Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues Museum. Bob, welcome to Offside.
Eric, thanks so much for having me.
So, Bob, the Negro League Museum was founded in 1990. And it's the only museum on the planet dedicated to preserving and celebrating the rich history of African-American baseball and its impact on the social advancement of America. And that is from your site. That's the mandate of the museum. If you were to tell someone, okay, this is what the museum is about, what would you say?
It's about this country's shameful period of history, segregation, but also how this league triumphed over that adversity. And it's an amazing experience that is so much bigger than the game of baseball. Baseball is merely a premise for a far more grandiose story as we look at it from the context of social advancement in this country. And segregation was a horrible chapter in this country's history. But out of segregation rose this wonderful story of triumph and conquest. And Eric, is based on one small, simple principle. You won't let me play with you, then I'll just create a league of my own. And that league, the Negro Leagues, would then rise to rival and in many instances surpass Major League Baseball in popularity and in attendance. And that to me is what makes it such a compelling and awe-inspiring story.
The players who played in the Negro Leagues include Jackie Robinson, Josh Gibson, who was the Black Babe Ruth, Satchel Paige, Buck O'Neill, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Campanella, Ernie Banks. The list goes on and on and on. And it was just a wonderful opportunity for these great baseball players to do their thing. And really, Bob, there was no difference between Major League Baseball players and players in the Negro Leagues except for the color of their skin, right?
That's it. And I tell people, and it's difficult, Eric, for baseball fans in particular to understand that there were two leagues operating in this country parallel to one another. Because one, we know virtually everything about the major leagues, or we've got a place to turn to find out almost any and everything about that league, which gave the best white athlete an opportunity to showcase his world-class baseball ability. Well, the Negro Leagues did the exact same thing, but for the best Black and Hispanic players to showcase their world-class baseball ability in this country. But outside of that, there was no difference. The only difference really between the Negro Leagues and Major League Baseball was money. Major League Baseball had more money. They had their own stadiums. the Negro Leagues, by and large, did not have the kind of stadium access that was available to Major League Baseball, which is part of the reason that created the challenges for the Negro Leagues, because they were renting the ballparks from those Major League teams. And so, but fundamentally, man, that's the difference. Major League rosters were a little bit larger, again, but that's money. They had more money. But from a talent standpoint, nah, the Negro Leagues wouldn't take a backseat to any league.
Speaking of the Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, which is located in Kansas City, Major League Baseball, Bob, recently announced that it was elevating the Negro Leagues to Major League status, and as a result, recognizing the statistics and records as part of baseball's history. When you heard that, what was your reaction?
You know, fortunately, I was kind of privy to the information before it was announced publicly, and everybody, you know, it just reverberated when this announcement occurred on Wednesday. Our phones immediately started to ring off the hook, and you know, I've probably taken part now in maybe 30-40 interviews since last Wednesday, and that's exciting. I am glad to see the reaction that it generated. I'll be honest, Eric, when I first caught wind, and let me preface by saying I didn't even know about this 1968-69 commission that was put together by baseball to examine these other leagues and then ultimately elevated them, or recognized them, I should say, as major league, and then blatantly dismissed the Negro Leagues. So unless you really dug into the annals of baseball history, very few folks knew anything about this. Well, someone did discover this and they wrote about it. And then all of a sudden it was starting to build up a lot of inquisitiveness from fans wanting to know, well, this is wrong. Are you going to change this? Are you going to fix this? And when I first heard about it, I was a little taken aback, to be honest, you know, because I'm so close to this story and I knew so many of these players, and they were very proud athletes. They did not need someone to validate them. Eric, they knew how good they were. And they knew how good their league was. And so they never sought validation from anyone. And so, and that was almost my position, like, well, we don't need you to validate us. But that, I had to literally step outside myself. And what I mean is, I'm on the inside and I'm projecting outwardly. I'm so close to it. I had to think about it from the fan's perspective of looking outside in. And when I started to look at it from that respect, the real historical significance really started to come into being for me. And the acceptance that this was not necessarily validating them. It was a historical validation of saying we made an egregious mistake. And honestly, mistake is too kind, because it was blatant dismissal, because there's no way that you can deny that the Negro Leagues was one of the great leagues that were ever formed in this country. Even before integration, Eric, the Negro Leagues were having a significant impact on Major League Baseball. As I mentioned earlier, they were renting many Major League stadiums. And so they were filling up those ballparks. And the major league teams were getting a percentage of the gate and likely all of the concession. So they were making money for Major League Baseball even prior to integration. But when we look, and the interesting thing about it was they were outdrawing those same major league teams that they were renting the stadium from, yet they were deemed inferior. And then when you look at 1947 and Jackie Robinson breaking into Major League Baseball, and then that opening up this pipeline for tremendous Black and Hispanic talent to now move into the major leagues. What happened was, in essence, Major League Baseball got its largest influx of talent at one time than in the history of this league. And yet this talent was being siphoned from the Negro League. This league that was somehow deemed inferior.
You know, Bob, it's interesting because when I was reading up on the Negro Leagues, the one thing that that I did start thinking about was, were these players in need of validation? As I look back, I look at a guy, for example, like Sammy Davis Jr., who wanted to be included, and someone who supported Richard Nixon. But I would imagine for other people, when you are expressly excluded, then your reaction is, well, I'm going to do my own thing. And so people might believe that these players were happy to be included in the fold in Major League Baseball. But I would imagine, Bob, there were some players like, you know what, once you go to hell, I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah, no, and you can understand that. That is human nature. They built this incredible enterprise. And I don't want the owners of those teams to be forgotten as well, because they're the ones that finance this very enterprising league that created this opportunity for these players to showcase their abilities. And so they had built this great league, and you siphon out all of this talent from this league, which ultimately is what put the Negro Leagues out of business. And yet you still look at it as somehow inferior when it had so tremendously impacted your league in ways in which these other leagues, Eric, the Federal League and these other leagues, had no impact of any significance on Major League Baseball. So that's why I say it was a blatant dismissal by the commission not to recognize the Negro Leagues as exactly what it was, a major league. And so we get to this milestone date of last Wednesday when the commissioner announced that they were going to right that wrong. In essence, make a correction to the pages of their own history, which is in essence starting to rewrite the pages of American history books, which is what we had hoped to do as an institution for the last 30 years of our existence. You know, it was about preserving and celebrating and illuminating and educating people about this story that very few baseball fans knew anything about. But our long-range goal was to one day rewrite the pages of American history books so that it would include this incredible chapter, and literally with one fell swoop of the pen, Major League Baseball started that last week.
Speaking with Bob Kendrick, president of Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, I am delighted to have him on the show. You know, Bob, typically sports is accused of being behind the times, being out of step. April 15th, 1947, Jackie Robinson plays his first Major League Baseball game for the Dodgers. Again, 1947, that's about 15 years or so before the Jim Crow laws were no longer enforced. From your standpoint, because everyone's context is different, my context will differ from your context. From your standpoint, looking at April 15th, 1947, do you see baseball being ahead of the curve, or do you see something else?
Ahead of the curve. Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier, Eric, was not only an important part of the civil rights movement in this country, it was the beginning of the civil rights movement. This is well prior to those more noted civil rights occurrences in this country. This is before Brown versus the Board of Education. This is before Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as the late great Buck O'Neill would so eloquently say, was a sophomore at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, when Robinson signed his contract to play in the Dodgers organization. President Truman would not integrate the armed forces until a year after Jackie. So for all intents and purposes, this is what indeed started the ball of social progress rolling in America. And so while baseball had certainly been vilified for not allowing blacks to play in its league, when it opened its door, this country essentially followed suit. And I think it speaks to the reverence that baseball held and to a large extent still holds in this country.
Speaking with Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So, Bob, given what you do as the president of this museum, and a museum dedicated, as you said, to social advancement, my assumption is that you see it as a good thing when athletes today and then were engaged as activists. Arthur Ashe, Lou Alcindor, Jackie Robinson, all the way up to LeBron James. Players should engage, should they not?
Absolutely. And you can go even further back than that. Jesse Owens, Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, if you recall, Eric, became one of the most despised athletes in certainly in American sports history for his unpopular stance at that time on the Vietnam War. when Muhammad Ali died, he was the most revered athlete on the face of the planet because of that stance that he took. And historically, history has always sided with the athlete in terms of protest. And they absolutely should use their profile to advance social causes. We've got issues. We've got issues in this country as it relates to trying to bridge the gap between race relations in this country. And it has always been a part of sports. And I think it absolutely should. Even the Negro Leagues in their own way, you know, were swinging and taking the opportunity for advancement. You know, they were playing for, they didn't realize this, but they were playing for so much more than just themselves and their team. You know, and so Jackie Robinson is carrying 21 million black folks on his back when he walked across those lines to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And think about this. Had he failed, an entire race of people would have failed. An enormous amount of pressure on Jackie. And when I hear someone of the magnitude of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who's the greatest civil rights leader in this country's history, say that I could not have done what Jackie Robinson did, it gives you a full understanding of the challenge that Robinson faced. Because when he stepped out on that baseball field, he's by himself. You know, he's got his teammates, but his teammates really didn't want him to be there. You know,
no, that's right, because there were teammates, Bob, his own teammates. Some of them voted against him joining the team. People don't know this, but people, some of his own teammates voted against him joining the team, right?
Yeah, no, it wasn't like he was welcome with open arms.
No, he was not.
And really, he felt more welcome when he went to Montreal in Canada. Yeah, he felt more welcome. He and Mrs. Robinson absolutely adored their time in Montreal, where the Canadians treated them as their natural selves. And so when he joined Brooklyn, now, ain't nobody sitting there waiting to welcome him. He had to earn his way, and he had to earn the respect of those in that dugout and in that locker room, and he did so. And that's why you had to have the right guy, you know, because the first guy, as you know, cannot fail. If Jackie fails, there is no second guy. That's what's at stake.
Speaking with Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, speaking of what's at stake, messaging for the museum, I assume, over time sort of changes and tries to adapt to the current situation. We watch George Floyd get murdered and crushed to death before our very eyes. I would presume, Bob, at this point for your museum, you look at the museum and its mandate and its mission as being as important as ever.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, I think the museum is more important right now than ever before for the very things that you alluded to. And if I was going to take any solace out of that very tragic occurrence that we saw, we all witnessed with our own eyes of George Floyd literally having a knee on his neck and being killed, is that so many people started to turn to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum for thought leadership in dealing with social issues. And Eric, that is with the understanding that our museum is a social justice museum. It's a civil rights museum. It is just seen through the lens of baseball. But more importantly, it is triumph over that adversity. And that is so significant because I don't want the only image of me as a black man in this country to be the downtroddenness that has been a part of my ascent in this country, moving from slavery through the civil rights movement and in a search for equality. You know, you've seen me in shackles. You've seen me sprayed by water hoses, the police dogs released on me, the police brutality that sadly still manifests itself to this very day in this country. Those are the visuals that you have of me. I don't want that to be the only image that you see of me. I need you to also see my success stories, because I can tell you there is no commonality in those things, you know, that have been a part of my quest for equality in this country. There are very few people who can relate to those struggles, but you can relate to my success stories. And the Negro Leagues are one of those great success stories. And so, again, as we in this country continue the needed work to bridge the racial gap. It's important that history can be one of our best teachers. And the more we know about one another, I think the easier it is for us to get along, because what we learn is that we have far more in common than we do differences, but our differences are not things that we should be running from. We should be celebrating our differences and our uniqueness, because those are the things that make us unique. And so through the lens of baseball and through the lens of this very compelling and awe-inspiring story, I think that we do a great job in starting to help bridge that racial gap and create greater appreciation for culture and heritage, diversity and inclusion and equity and respect and tolerance through this story.
Speaking to the eloquent Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, players who played in the Negro Leagues include Jackie Robinson, Josh Gibson, Sagil Page, Buck O'Neill, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Roy Campanella. List goes on and on and on. Bob, there aren't as many African-American boys playing baseball as there were before. Is part of your mission as the head of this museum to try and get more young African-American boys and girls to play baseball?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's important that they understand that we have a proud legacy in this sport. And I understand that Major League Baseball and the Players Association are doing, they've made a concerted effort to try and open this game up for those who are underserved, particularly those who are in urban cores who may not be afforded the means necessary to play our game any longer. And that's important. And I think it only enhances the relationship that we have with Major League Baseball and the Players Association, because our children need to see themselves in this light. And so when they come to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, they see people who look just like them, who played this game as well as anyone ever played this game. But not only did they play the game, they owned teams. They were managers and they were coaches and they were traveling secretaries and team physicians. They fulfill everything that you could possibly do in the business of our game, and that's important as well. But it's aspirational by nature, and so you have to see yourself in that light. And I think the museum plays a great role in helping them identify and gain a greater sense of self.
Speaking of important, I would presume that you welcome the support of current Major League Baseballs when it comes to the museum.
Oh, absolutely. The more the merrier. And of course, the thing that hurt me this year in our 100th anniversary celebration is the fact that the Major League teams couldn't visit the museum. They were all basically quarantined when they came into the cities. And so the only team that we were able to play host to was the Pittsburgh Pirates. And their manager actually put in a special request, which allowed us to do that. And then we shut the museum down so that they could have complete private access to it. And so anytime that we get the young athlete in, it is welcome, because we want them to understand this history. And as you well know, no sport holds to its history the way baseball does. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that they understand their place in this game. And whether you're black, white, Hispanic, it doesn't really matter. You know, all roads lead to the Negro League, and you gain a perspective. You gain a perspective about what others have had to do to play this game. And the sheer love of the game that they had, which allowed them to go through all the adversity that they had to go through. You know, can you imagine riding into a town, filling up the ballpark, and yet not being able to get a meal from the same fans who had just cheered you, or not have a place to stay? And so they would sleep on the bus and eat their peanut butter and crackers until they could get to a place that would offer them basic services, yet they would not allow that to kill their love of the game. So if I've got to sleep on the bus, and if I've got to eat my peanut butter and crackers, I'm going to keep playing ball. And that's the prevailing spirit that drove the Negro League. And so every player, I don't care what color you are, can relate to that love of the game. And in the end, Eric, I think it gives them a better perspective of just how good they have it today.
You have these players that are subjected to that hypocrisy and that hate on a daily basis. How are these human beings, these men, not filled with rage? And how does that not direct their path in life? How are they able to contain that and manage that?
It's amazing to me. It really is. And I think that is one of the things that endeared me to the players that I've had an opportunity to meet, you know, because if they had been bitter, we all would have said, you have every right to be bitter. And not a player that I ever met, Eric, harbored any ill will or bitterness toward anyone who may have attempted to perpetrate something against them as they were trying to play baseball in this country. And it is that spirit that resonates. And it's that spirit, I think, that we need to be in tune with today. And so, it did. It really did. It endeared me to them even more when I got involved with the museum now 27 years ago as a volunteer. And I just fell deeper in love with the story and with these amazing athletes who made this story.
Would you say that a baseball fan or even just anybody taking a trip to visit your museum is they by virtue of visiting the museum, they are engaging in social justice?
Oh, there's no question, because you're learning. You're learning. And, you know, hate, man, is a true sign of ignorance. It really is. And so that's why I think when we introduce people to this story and you understand what others have had to go through, and for the kids in particular who come into our museum and they're being introduced to segregation for the very first time, and to a child, they see segregation and they summarize it very simply. That was dumb. And they're right. It was dumb. But it was the way that this country was. And it's important that they understand how this country was and that life hasn't always been as good as it is today for some of its citizens. You know, the idea that you could go to jail for sitting in the wrong section of a ballpark or drinking from the wrong water fountain or using the wrong restroom. And quite frankly, Eric, going to jail was some of the good things that happened. A lot of people lost their lives for breaking those simple societal standards in this country. And so we take this very complex subject matter, segregation, difficult for us as adults to understand, no less our children, and try to simplify it by telling it through the eyes of these very courageous ball players. And so that is what this museum is all about. And that's why I call it a social justice museum, a civil rights museum. And so, yeah, people, I think, gain a much better understanding and I truly believe a greater appreciation for the power of the human spirit to persevere and prevail.
Well, speaking of appreciation, Bob, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out and joining me on Offside. Your comments are invaluable and best of luck continuing to engage in social justice.
Eric, thanks so much, man. It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for reaching out. And, you know, I look forward to getting back to your neck of the woods sometime in the very near future.
Eric McRamala.
He is a sly. If he's allowed to go free, then something really wrong is going on.
Mr. Kirkland, you are out of order.
You're out of order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Sir, you're out of order.
Out of order. I show you out of order. You don't know what out of order is, Mr.
McRamala.
I'd show you, but I'm too old. I'm too tired. I'm too blind. If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place.
Welcome back to the show that is Offside. I am your host, Eric Macromalis. Steve Lloyd is away this week. He's down at Comic-Con, walking around dressed like Captain Kirk. In this segment, I'm going to be in conversation with Rem Pitlick of the Montreal Canadiens, and joining me for this interview is John Hollywood Still from TSN 690. And in this interview, I kind of wanted to delve into some hockey, but more importantly, perhaps more focus of the interview, is Rem Pitlick's family. His dad, Lance Pitlick, played for the Senators and the Panthers, played nearly 400 games in the NHL. His brother, Rhett, was drafted by the Montreal Canadiens. His brother, Tyler, has played for the Montreal Canadiens. His mom, Lisa, was an Olympic-caliber gymnast, had to give it up, I believe, due to injury. But I've heard a lot of good things about this family. It seemed pretty buttoned up, focused. They care for each other. And hockey and sports, while it appears to be central in their lives, doesn't define them. And here is that conversation with Rem Pitlick.
All right, so let me start with this, Rem. So your father, Lance, played 339 NHL games for the Panthers and the Sens. Your brother, Rhett, was drafted by the Canadiens in 2019. Your cousin, Tyler, played for the Habs. Your mom, Lisa, was an Olympic-level gymnast. Let me ask you just a really simple, straightforward question. What has sports meant to you and your family?
Yeah, it means a lot. I'm not going to say it's everything. But it, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sports going on in the family, and I think it's just something that we've all used to kind of connect and bond with each other. And, you know, I don't know, it's just something that we've all liked. So it's fun to share similar interests and values with all those people in our family. So I think it just brings us together, more times than not, and we're able to just have fun with each other. So it's meant a lot in our life.
And I know you played a lot of pond hockey with your brother and your cousin. I'm just curious, you know, to what extent did that pond hockey help you to develop as the hockey player that you are today?
I think it played a big role. I mentioned in one of the interviews that I had in Montreal when Tyler had come, I think as a little kid growing up, it was one of the things I always looked forward to the most in my life was, you know, our boot hockey or pond hockey tournaments at our Christmas party at our grandparents' house. And I'd always be so pumped when Tyler was there because obviously he's 6 years older than me and he wasn't always there, sometimes traveling with teams. He was already playing pro. So when he would come, I just, you know, have star eyes. And so that was very fun. And, you know, obviously you're out there having fun, but you're working on your skills at the same time. But I would say since Rhett and I grew up in the same house, we spent a lot of time in our backyard. Very fortunate that my mom and dad, like the one thing that they were looking for when they went and bought a house in Minnesota was, did it have a pond? So I think that was kind of in their plan as parents to allow us those outdoor experiences. So Rhett and I had a lot of fun together playing outside. And Rhett, you know, at the time, 4 years younger than me, you know, when you're that young, you know, seems significantly younger. And he always, you know, it was always a challenge to beat him. He was always very competitive with me. So we had some hard-fought battles, and we had a lot of fun. I think it developed a lot of our skills, creativity, and hard work, all the above. So it was great.
Speaking of Rem Pitlick, Habs 4, this is Tut versus Hollywood. Okay, Rem, I've got two older brothers. If you ask either of us about any other brothers, the word that we will all use is dumbass, okay? So when I came across this following sentence, it blew my mind. Your brother, Rhett, said this about you, quote, "I think my brother is one of the wisest people I've ever spoken to in my life," end quote. Okay, first, just teach me how to get my kids to get along with that, and why does he think you're the wisest guy around?
I don't know. Maybe I'd say the same thing about him, but I think it kind of comes back to you know, the sports thing, when you say, you know, how do you get your siblings to look at other people like that? I think it's just, you know, as a family, sports have meant a lot. It hasn't meant everything, but it's something that we've all had fun. Sometimes I think there's just been so much fun. So we're just like good friends because we've just, you know, all been having fun all the time. And as far as like the wisest stuff, I think that we're just kind of curious, open-minded people. We've had a lot of cool people coming in and out of our lives, but it does start at home with our mom and dad. And I think that they've always suggested to us to follow our curiosity, whether it's reading books or having certain experiences in life. I think that's kind of where maybe he'd say that. I don't know. I'm a curious guy, and so is he. And we kind of surround ourselves with people that are the same. And I guess closing that out, my dad has always talked about like a quote that he's, you know, paraphrased, you know, since we were kids, is you kind of become like the people that you spend the most time around. So I think Rhett and I are very conscientious of that.
You know, Rem, you've mentioned twice in this interview now that sports is something, but it's not everything. And is it a situation in your family where sports is used as a vehicle to teach you how to be good people and teach you how to achieve great things? It's not only about sports, but it's using sports as a metaphor?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, my dad, he has a hockey business at home in Minnesota, and he does like some online, he sells online programs and he does private lessons, but he recently, like 6 months ago, started a podcast. And, you know, I'm not really involved in the business, but I always like to talk to him and see what his, you know, his visions are. And he kind of created the podcast with that. That's something that we discussed. You know, hockey has allowed us to experience so much in life and learn so much about ourselves, and, you know, all the lessons, the hardships, the great times, all the above. It's really like this journey, like this, this life story of being a human being and just trying to be a better person. So that's really about it. That's what it's about for us. And it just happens to be this thing that we have a lot of fun doing. And so I think that you really hit the nail on the head there.
It's Montreal Canadiens forward Rem Pitlick here on Tut versus Hollywood here on TSN 690. Rem, I do want to get to just what I think was pretty surprising to most Montreal Canadiens fans, which was that initially you were not qualified by the Habs, especially after your breakout year after coming over here on waivers. What was that time like for you? Were the lines of communication open between you and the Canadiens? Did you have a semblance of what was happening from the beginning? Just can you take me through that time of not getting the qualifying offer to signing the 2-year contract extension with the Habs?
Yeah, there was communication the whole time, and I think that the intention the whole time was for me to come back, and that's what I wanted. That was the only thing that I really discussed about with my agent, and Montreal knew that, and I think that they reciprocated those same feelings to me, and I think that was really the point the whole time. Like, whatever, on the outside, everyone can kind of think what they want or, well, why did that happen? But I think that both sides were in agreement that somehow we were going to make this happen. We didn't know how, but it was going to happen, and it did. And I'm super excited. I'm like super grateful, and yeah, I'm pumped up.
There's no doubt that things have been, you know, fluid for you since you broke into the NHL, and your father didn't make the NHL until he was 27 years old. So does he offer kind of a unique perspective from your standpoint with respect to how it is you make it and how you define success?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really fortunate to have a dad who has traveled that journey, and, you know, my cousin as well, because he's older than me and he's had a lot of experiences in the game. And I definitely turn to those two when I have questions or things that maybe I'm scratching my head about. And, but at the same time, I really appreciate from both of them that they recognize that I'm not them and they're not me, and I'm going to have my own experiences. So, you know, despite the fact that they have their own formula for how they did it, they recognize and allow me to understand that I'm going to have my own way of doing it too. So it's a really healthy relationship that we can go back and forth and kind of, you know, pitch ideas back and forth. And it helps me make my decisions and feel good about those decisions.
Speaking of Rem Pitlick, Montreal Canadiens forward. So Rem, when I say Rem Pitlick, Montreal Canadiens forward, like how does that resonate with you?
It resonates 100%. I feel like that's exactly where I'm supposed to be. I don't know. People who know me well, I'm definitely a person that, you know, things happen for a reason. And, like, these are one of those things that, like, I think this happened for a reason. I feel like I'm exactly where I'm meant to be. And it feels right. And I'm super excited to, come back. And I have a lot to prove for myself. And I want to use that as a way to impact the team in a positive way, because we have a lot to prove as a team. So I'm just excited with all those dynamics coming together. And I think next season is going to be a great season.
The Montreal Canadiens hiring of Marty St. Louis was a bold hiring, and it was outside the box. His only really coaching experience was, you know, coaching Bantam hockey. He shows up. He seems like such an intelligent, thoughtful person, a really good teacher, and someone who willed his way to the Hall of Fame. From your standpoint, what makes Marty St. Louis a good coach?
I would say everything that you just said. For somebody to go through all those tests and things that you have to go through internally as an athlete to get to where you want to go, and do it in a team sport that, you know, it's not an individual sport. He's not a golfer. He's not a martial artist, whatever, you're a gymnast. You know, well, I guess they're all teams in their own way, but, you know, he's out there on the ice competing with other people, and how to, you know, all those lessons that he had to learn to get to where he had to be. He's just worn all the hats. And I think when you wear all the hats, you're able to relate to everyone, because there's a lot of people wearing a lot of different hats. And I think that's what makes him so amazing.
We'll get you out on this, Rem. Speaking of Rem Pitlick, with the Montreal Canadiens, we talk about your dad, Lance, your brother, Rhett, your cousin, Tyler. It's only fair we talk about your mom, Lisa. She was a great athlete on her own. Sorry?
I said, yeah, she would appreciate that.
Yeah, she would. So she was an Olympic level gymnast. What has your mom meant to you as far as your professional development and your development as a human being?
The world, everyone says that their mom's the best mom. Well, I feel the same way about my mom. She means the world. And, you know, maybe most people would maybe assume that my dad was the one, he was a hockey player and he was pushing us, all that stuff. But it's honestly my mom. It's been a very interesting balance between my parents. I think it's been a really cool blend where You know, my dad's maybe more of the softer, have fun, do that. And my mom's the same way, but she definitely understands what it means to try to be a successful athlete. She's taught us a lot of lessons and, you know, all the same stories of just, you know, she's there doing whatever she can, working, driving us, making us dinners, whatever you can say. She was always there to make sure that we were taken care of. So she's the epitome of Mama Bear. And I'm so grateful. And I know my brother's grateful. And without her, we would not be where we're at. And without her, we're not going to have the mindset to kind of keep going to where we want to try to get to, hopefully. So I'm super grateful to her. And yeah, we love her.
Rem, thanks a lot for joining us. And good luck with the rest of the offseason.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on, guys. And yeah, we'll see you soon.
They're losers. They're just losers.
Suffers from a thing called loser's remorse. She lost.
Well, Rosie's a loser. She's always been a loser. We have losers. We have losers.
And Cher is somewhat of a loser. She's lonely. She's unhappy.
Look, Glenn's a loser, okay? Just so you understand. This guy's a serious loser.
Welcome back to Offside. Look, I don't have a lot of time here for my Donald Trump Loser of the Week, so I'm going to have to just serve up the shorter version of my Donald Trump Loser of the Week. And this week, it's the fact that hander pants are not more popular. Hander pants are underpants for your hands. They're for sale on Amazon for $23.40. They're stylish for any occasion. They fit most adult hands, hundreds of uses, and they are a wonderful gift. Yes, that is hander pants, underpants for your hands. They haven't been successful. They're not selling a lot. And so all of you out there not buying hander pants, you are my Donald Trump Loser of the Week.
Nobody's stronger than me.
Nobody has better toys than I do.
Nobody builds walls better than me.
There's nobody that's done so much for equality as I have.
There is nobody that respects women more than I do.
The sale of the uranium, that nobody knows what it means. I know what it means.
Nobody knows more about trade than me.
Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it.
All right, flesh out of time. Thanks so much for listening, and we will chat soon. I love you.